with the Mises Institute, but we wanted it to be a more general text, and that's why I don't stress certain Austrian terminology in the book, and I don't go out of my way to talk about Austrian economics. I mean, everything in the book is, of course, consistent with Austrian economics, but it's supposed to be a more general introduction to free market thinking as opposed to the Austrian school. And so in the interest of, you know, trying to invite as many people in as possible, and also because we know a lot of homeschooling families might be interested in the book, like I say, I really did struggle with, do I want to put this in there or not, this chapter on drug prohibition. I mean, I'm, just so you know, a Christian, and I go to church, and they're very politically conservative, and I can just imagine, you know, my pastor reading the book and seeing that chapter, and he might raise an eyebrow, right, because he might think, oh, so you're saying drug use is fine, so, which of course is not what we're saying. But in any event, I did struggle with that, but why did I keep it in there? Because in addition to things like understanding the minimum wage and inflation, I think in terms of using basic economic tools that you learn in the first parts of the book to understand something that's really important in the real world and understand the pernicious role that government intervention has, the drug prohibition is, like I say, lost video there for a second. Okay. The stuff we see in the real world related to the drug trade, I would argue most of it is due to drug prohibition and not the drug trade per se. All right. So that's what we're going to go through and focus on. So before diving into the analysis, let me give some standard disclaimers. So the first thing is, look, there's a distinction between something being immoral and being illegal. So I don't want to be coy about it. I think drugs, and when I say drugs, I mean illicit drugs that are currently prohibited, because, of course, caffeine is a drug, alcohol is a drug, nicotine is a drug. And so it's, you know, when people talk about the drug war, some critics of it clarify and say, you mean the war on some drugs, right? Because it's not really that the government and, you know, preachers and moralists are against drug use. They're against the use of particular drugs, okay? And I don't even mean just medical drugs. Like I said, caffeine, nicotine, alcohol, those are drugs too. And a lot of people, when they say, oh, I think drugs should stay illegal, they don't mean we should go ban cigarettes, or at least a lot of them don't mean that. Okay, so like I say, I don't want to be coy. I do think that a better policy would be if the government legalized the use and distribution and production of drugs that are currently illegal. But that doesn't mean that, therefore, I think, you know, that's a great thing and I'm celebrating the lifestyle of, you know, using heroin or something. And it's not, a lot of times I think conservative critics of libertarians believe that that's just some real nitpicky thing where they're hiding behind some logical justification, when really they're just hiding their true agenda. But I mean, in general, this distinction is pretty straightforward. So for example, I think most people would agree that cheating on your wife is immoral, that you're a jerk if you do it, but they don't think that marital infidelity should be a crime, right? So they think that a philanderer like Bill Clinton deserves our moral condemnation, or, you know, that we should think less of him because of what he did, but most people don't think he should have had criminal charges because he, you know, had an affair, right? Maybe they think he's unfit for office and he should have lost his job, but I don't remember anybody saying that Bill Clinton should have gone to jail because he cheated on his wife, or that, you know, Tiger Woods belongs behind bars because he cheated on his wife. And if somebody did say that, if someone said, hey, why don't we lock up Tiger Woods and put him behind bars, and then somebody else said, whoa, I don't think marital infidelity should be a crime, you know, it'd be silly to say, oh, so you're celebrating spousal infidelity. You're, you know, you think there's nothing wrong with it. And that would be silly, right? You say, no, it's just, some things, even though they're immoral, shouldn't be crimes. Another example I use often is to say, you know, swearing at your grandmother. I mean, that's a pretty rotten thing to do. Like, if in anger you're swearing at your own grandmother, I mean, that's really, you know, immoral. But obviously shouldn't be a crime. Okay, on the other hand, there are plenty of things that are technically illegal, but in the grand scheme, it's not that big a deal. Right? So if a 15-year-old gets a thrill from shoplifting and steals, you know, a CD or something from the music store, I mean, yeah, the person just broke the law. But in the grand scheme, I mean, it's not that big a deal, or especially if you swipe like a pack of chewing gum or something. Okay, so I mean, it doesn't make it right, but you see, it's not that big a deal. And then there's other things that are technically violating the laws of the land that you might think are completely justifiable, right? So, you know, the United States, you go back to when there was the Fugitive Slave Act, there were plenty of people who were breaking the law by letting runaway slaves, you know, hide out in their cellar or what have you, and they were technically committing an illegal act. But most people today would say that they were not only doing something that was okay morally, but actually that what they were doing was very praiseworthy. Okay, so my point is, there's a distinction between what you think ought to be legal and what you think is moral. And we see this distinction in all sorts of areas of life. And so if somebody says, I don't think the government ought to be putting drug users or drug dealers behind bars, that does not mean the person thinks drug use is good or is glorifying drug use or wants his own kids to end up using heroin or something. All right, so that's perhaps an obvious disclaimer, but I thought it was important to make that point. Okay, another sort of caveat before we get into the basic economics here is framing the options. And what I mean by that is, a lot of times when you're debating on the issue of drug legalization, the people who are for prohibition, so the people who are in favor of the government using its power to penalize the sale of drugs and the use of it, they will start listing statistics about how awful drug use is. And they'll start, you know, listing things about, look at how many people are going to the emergency room. Look at, you know, the family's broken up by drug addiction, and, you know, listing those sorts of things. And so what I mean by framing the options is, let's be clear, we're not choosing. The question is not, would the world be better off if heroin didn't exist? All right, that, in my opinion, yeah, probably would be. All right, and I'm just, and the only reason I'm hedging myself is because I haven't really thought through the consequences of that, since that's not really an option. Okay? The question is not, would it be a good thing if cocaine were to disappear from the earth tomorrow? All right, the question is, should the government use its employees with guns to go around and try to physically grab people and then throw them in a cage if they get caught, you know, selling these items or get caught having large quantities on their person? Right? That's what we have the power. That's the thing we're choosing over. And so if you want to start talking about, oh, well, look at the problems of drug abuse, well, that's not enough. You need to show that those problems will be lower if you have a large-scale war on drugs, right? And it's like I say, it's not obvious that that's the case, especially in the United States, where the penalties for drug use aren't that high. I mean, they are high, but mostly the United States government focuses its attention on the drug dealers. All right, so there's plenty of people right now, even in prison, okay, that I don't have the numbers handy, but there are statistics showing how many people in the prisons get access to marijuana and cocaine and things like that, right? Because they bribe the guards and they get it that way. And so it's so the point is, if the government can't even keep drugs out of prisons, well, then it's clear that the policy of having drug prohibition is not preventing people from using drugs. So it's not correct to say, I'm in favor of the war on drugs because I think drug use is bad. That even if we stipulate, okay, drug use is bad, it would be good if drugs disappeared tomorrow, that's not the choice that we face. Okay, the last caveat is that in this chapter of the book, and then of course this lecture that's based on it, I'm going to be focusing on the downsides of drug prohibition. And the reason for doing that is that I think we all know what the potential upsides are. Okay, so I'm not going to, so in other words, I'm not giving you a balanced view. I'm not weighing the pros and the cons. I'm assuming that you guys know what some of the standard justifications for prohibiting things like cocaine and marijuana are. And then we're just going to say, okay, that those are things to consider. Those are possible benefits of it. But now let's look at the downside. And that's because the downsides are things that take economic analysis to really see. Whereas it's pretty obvious, you know, to say, oh, well, gee, if the father of a household becomes hooked on heroin, then he's going to eventually lose his job. He misses his responsibilities. The family falls apart. That's awful. We want to try to minimize that. And so maybe we'll ban heroin, and maybe that's what the technique, right? So that it doesn't take a real deep analysis to understand why avoiding drug addiction is a good thing. Okay, so you don't need to be an economist to understand why a lot of people are in favor of banning drugs, but you do need to understand economic principles to get the points I'm going to make later on in this lecture. So that's why we're focusing on those, because they're things that sort of, you know, the seen and the unseen. What we're talking about here are the unintended consequences of drug prohibition that economics specifically sheds light on. Okay, so one major category here is corruption. And it's, if you even just get a very slight familiarity with the drug trade and its interaction with the police, you'll soon realize that it can only function with the complicity of the police. All right, and then, I mean, basically any movie that Al Pacino's ever been in, you can watch to see that truth. But in case you're thinking, oh, it's just Hollywood, this movie Serpico, the reason I recommend that, and again, if you're able to watch R-rated movies, I know some of you are young, so parents be forewarned that this movie does have violence and probably some bad words in it, but it's based on a true story. This New York City police officer, Frank Serpico, and he was, a clean cop, meaning he wouldn't take dirty money, meaning he wouldn't take bribes from drug dealers, and so that got him in trouble. You might say, oh, the drug dealers didn't trust him. No, the other policemen on the vice squads and the drug units didn't trust him, because they were all on the take. They were all getting lots of money. This was, I think, in the 1970s when this happened. I don't know how much they got back then, but it was a lot of money for, you know, compared to their normal salary. And the fact that he wasn't taking the money, you know, they couldn't trust him, because they thought he was going to rat on them, or, you know, just, it was just weird in their mind. Like, why aren't you taking the money? You think okay, I see some people don't know. So that's who, you see Al Pacino, and then the other guy is Blagojevich, the disgraced Illinois governor, who had to step down because they caught him on tape basically trying to sell Senator Barack Obama's seat, right, because Obama, you know, became president, and so that seat was open, and then given the way the laws work, the governor gets to appoint the replacement until the next election. And so Blagojevich wasn't just going to say, well, gee, let me weigh the pros and cons of the various candidates and see who the person is that will best serve the citizens of our state. No, they caught him on tape being very frank about how, you know, I'm going to only give this to somebody who really, you know, gives me something in return. All right, and it's, what's funny, and a lot of people said this, is it's not that we think Blagojevich was any different from any other U.S. governor or major politician. It's just he happened to be caught. And a lot of people say that, you know, the FBI, that's partly how they maintain control over people, that they have wiretaps and stuff, like even among Congress people, and they have stuff on everybody. And that, you know, it's the reason they went after Blagojevich is because he wasn't playing ball. And so they, you know, they wanted to go after. I don't remember what the exact theory was. Okay, so that, anyway, that's neither here nor there, but the point is he's just a symbol of corruption. And so that's what we mean. What does corruption mean? Let me make sure I define that. It's when government officials are not performing their duties the way they're supposed to, the way the public thinks they're supposed to, because they're getting favors, generally money, you know, behind closed doors. So when it comes to police officers and the drug war, or it could even be judges or FBI agents, DEA agents, what have you, corruption means that there are government officials who know full well there's illegal drug activity occurring, and they look the other way. They don't stop it because they're getting paid off by those same drug dealers. All right, and so this is a huge problem. You know, like in Mexico, for example, if you've seen the movie Traffic, again, R-rated movie, so parents be careful. But that's fictitious, but I think it does a great job just showing how pervasive the corruption is, because it's even worse in Mexico than it is in the United States, where, you know, the drug cartels have certain key people in the government and the military that they just own. That, you know, they give those people so much money every month that those people are not going to go after them. And so what ends up happening is the government will take out the competitors of the people that are giving them money. And so it keeps, you know, the favored groups in control of the drug trade. And so, and it's, because the thing is, when you're, well, at least when I was younger, I was very naive. I thought that the only reason the drug trade existed was because all the drug dealers were, you know, hiding behind closed doors and were, like, on street corners, and that they saw a police car, they'd run away or something. And no, I mean, the major traffickers, the police know who they are. The DEA knows who they are. It's, they are paying off people, okay? And that's how it persists. I mean, because it's a huge operation to move all the items, you know, across the border and then to distribute it and so forth. I mean, it's a huge operation if you're talking about, like, the cocaine market in the United States. And so it's, that can't happen if every single government official in the United States were gung-ho about stamping out the drug trade. Then you wouldn't have the drug problem that we have right now. So corruption is a huge element of it. So let's just use economics and just walk through some of the reasons to see why is it that it happens. And it really is associated with the drug trade. Okay, I mean, it's true that occasionally, you know, like a mob boss or something might order a hit and then maybe pay off the police department to not investigate it or something. But, I mean, that's a lot less frequent than the mafia paying off the police to overlook drug dealing or to overlook, you know, having gambling going on and things like that, all right? So it's these things that are called, well, we'll get to the victimless crimes in a minute. But first of all, let's just focus on how drug prohibition fosters this culture of corruption. Okay, so the first and most obvious point is that there's huge bribes that are possible. Okay, so here, this is the way you would do a simple supply and demand analysis of prohibition. So the original supply and demand curves, S1 and D1, they intersect, and I'm just making these numbers up, obviously, at a price of $1 for 1 million grams of cocaine. Okay, so this is the market for cocaine. And then now there's prohibition in place. And so cocaine dealers know if they get caught, they go to jail. They get big fines. Or they get a big prison sentence. And they get their car seized and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And they might even die, right? If the FBI or the DEA or somebody bursts into their area in the middle of the night, you know, they might get shot. Okay, so it's very risky because of prohibition. And so that's why the supply curve moves way to the left. So make sure you understand that, that what we're saying is for various hypothetical market prices, market, of course, being a black market here, black market prices for cocaine, the various potential sellers in the market are willing to sell less if cocaine is illegal. Okay, and I mean, that's very intuitive, it's obvious, but just make sure you walk through and understand the logic and why the supply curve shifts way to the left. Okay, it's because now it's a much riskier thing. All right? So, also at the same time, the demand shifts left. But I have the demand shifting by a lot less than supply. And the reason for that is just the way things work out, at least certainly in the United States, and I imagine in other major countries too, the penalties for drug sale are much higher than for drug use. Okay, and partly that's the way they do that is just it's based on quantity, right? So if you get pulled over by the police and they open your trunk and you've got like a little bag of marijuana in there, you're going to get in trouble, but not much. But if you have 30 pounds of marijuana in your trunk, you're going to get in big trouble because they're going to say you're a dealer, right? And so the penalties for having that much on you are much bigger than the penalties for having just a little amount that's probably for personal consumption. Okay, so that's one reason that the supply curve shifts left a lot more than the demand curve. Another reason is just the nature of it, that if your occupation is being a drug dealer, you're a lot more likely to get caught doing that than if you just occasionally go out and buy drugs, right? Because, I mean, there's various reasons for it, but for one thing, if you're a drug dealer, you always have a lot of drugs on you or, you know, in your house or something, whereas if you're just a casual user, sometimes you might not even have any on you, and, you know, even if you do have some in your house, it's not like you're walking around all the time with it on you, whereas if you're a drug dealer and you're making deals or something, I mean, you're going to have it on you, or depending on how high up you are in an organization, maybe you personally don't have a bunch of cocaine on you, but maybe you've got 30 guys working for you, and they all have it on them, or some of them do, and if any of them get caught, they might give your name up to the police and say, yeah, this is my boss, you know, he's the kingpin. Okay, so my point is, if it's your way of life, if it's your career is to be a drug dealer, you are far more vulnerable to the laws against drugs than somebody who's one of your customers. Okay, so and also too, I mean, just the way the police, their incentives are, they're going to want to go after the big fish, right? So the higher up you are, the more of a dealer you are, the bigger target you have in terms of just the law if the police want to come after you. Whereas, you know, the police are doing a sting and they see people coming and going to an apartment complex because they think there's a drug dealer in there. I mean, the police might not even bother arresting the actual customers who are coming and going. Who cares about those guys? We're going after the guy in the apartment building who's selling the drugs. Okay, so that's what I mean. The police's budget is limited. They can't go out and prosecute or arrest every potential lawbreaker they see out there. They're going to, you know, limit their activities and try to focus on the ones that they think are the big fish. Okay, so again, all these different reasons. I'm just trying to explain why it is in this diagram I made the supply curve move way to the left, whereas I only made the demand curve move a little bit. All right, so what that ends up meaning is, first of all, the equilibrium output, equilibrium quantity, goes way down. So with these numbers that I made up, I went from 1 million grams down to 10,000 grams. And the market price goes way up. So again, with these numbers, I made it go from $1 to $100 for a gram. I have seen estimates saying that, you know, the street price of cocaine is possibly 1,000 times higher because of drug prohibition than it would be if in a world where, you know, there were no government sanctions on cocaine. All right, so these, you know, numbers are in the ballpark, right? That it is buying cocaine, you know, the price of cocaine per unit weight is far, far higher today than it would be if we got rid of drug prohibition. Okay, so that's partly what makes these huge bribes possible. Right, that being a drug dealer is very lucrative monetarily. All right. So part of what's happening here is that, you know, the price needs to go way up in order to get some people to be willing to do it. Because in a sense, being a cocaine dealer is now a lot more dangerous than it was before. So just like, you know, there needs to be hazard pay for people to work in coal mines that might collapse, by the same token, being a cocaine dealer now is a lot more dangerous than being an aspirin dealer, you know, than being, you know, running a pharmacy. And so that's partly why the price goes way up, to compensate the dealers so that some of them stay in the market. But precisely because the monetary returns are so high, that means they have a lot of money to throw around, and so they have the ability to pay, you know, police officers and judges and FBI agents huge sums of money. Okay, another aspect, so again, what we're talking about is why is it that there is such a culture of corruption among government officials when it comes to the drug trade. So the first one we talked about is because drug dealers have huge, you know, cash flow, and so they have the ability to offer large bribes. Another reason, I think, to explain this is the distinction between what's called victimless crimes and versus crimes that have actual victims. All right, and why this concept interplays with the amount of corruption. So, for one thing, just so you guys know, there are a lot of people that don't like this term victimless crime, because they're going to say, like with drug use, oh, come on, if some guy gets addicted and beats his wife or loses his job or something, you know, that's, don't say there's not a victim there. His family is the victim, okay? So we don't mean to be downplaying the social consequences of drug use here, but what we mean when we say victimless crime is that there is something categorically different in these two pictures I put up here. All right, somebody, even though both of these things are illegal in the current United States, on the left here, that's illegal. You're not supposed to be dealing drugs like that. And also, grabbing somebody and mugging him, which is depicted on the right, is also illegal. But there's an important sense in which, after that activity on the left, nobody's complaining, right? Both of those people, the drug dealer and his customer, are engaging in a voluntary transaction. It's the government that's coming along and saying, whoa, we don't like you guys doing that. Don't do that or we're going to throw you in jail. Whereas the thing on the right here, that guy's getting mugged. He certainly is not agreeing to that. All right, so after this mugging, he's a victim, and he's going to go run to the police if he thinks that, you know, there's any point in doing that and saying, hey, I just got mugged. Whereas the thing on the left, there's nobody in this transaction who's going to report anything. I mean, there might be neighbors looking out of their window and seeing it and calling the police, but you get the categorical difference. There's nothing in the transaction per se that's generating somebody who's going to complain, because it's a voluntary transaction. And the same thing with, you know, gambling, prostitution, what's called loan sharking, so giving loans to people and charging a very high rate of interest. These are all things that are illegal in varying degrees, and at least in the United States, in many jurisdictions, but they're business transactions, they're commercial transactions, they're exchanges of property that just, for various reasons, a lot of people don't like, and so that there are legal penalties. Okay, so there's a lot flowing from this. For one thing, just as an aside, this is why you need to have subpoenas and things like that, all right, where you have to compel people to testify, because there's no victim, at least in the conventional sense. And so it's, whereas with a conventional crime, there's somebody complaining to the police, okay? And so, you know, there's a lot of things that we just take for granted about how the judicial system works wouldn't be there if it weren't for this category of crimes that are referred to as victimless crimes. But for our purposes, I think this partly explains why it is that there's so much corruption when it comes to things like drug dealing and gambling and so on. Because, you know, think of it from the point of view of the police officer or the judge or whatever, FBI agent. It's not, you can see how they could be taking money from people who are just dealing drugs, right? And that they could think in the grand scheme they're not doing anything too wrong. So I'm thinking of it from the police officer's point of view who's receiving the drug money, especially if that police officer is out arresting plenty of drug dealers every day and just happens to be getting paid off from somebody else, and he just knows, okay, I don't arrest people from that gang because they're paying me, but I still arrest, you know, the random punk drug dealers around the town. You could see how that person would think, look, in the grand scheme, I'm not doing anything that's that wrong, and I'm getting a ton of money. Whereas, if a hitman were paying them off, and they knew that what that guy's work was is going around shooting people and killing them, and that that's what he gets paid to do, you could see how, you know, it would be a lot more difficult for somebody to morally justify that, to be able to sleep at night knowing I'm getting paid thousands of dollars a month extra from an assassin. Okay, whereas somebody who sells drugs to willing customers and, you know, there's no one immediately harmed by that transaction, you could see how, what's the big deal? Like, yeah, it's a vice, and those people shouldn't be doing that, and it's not good for their families, but that's categorically different from somebody, you know, from getting paid off by bank robbers, let's say. Okay, so that's what my point is on this slide, that even though those police officers, if you asked them and said, hey, is it a victimless crime, even though they would say, oh, no, it's not, and it should be illegal, I think deep down they recognize there's a categorical difference, and that's why. So let me put it this way. I don't think there would be nearly as much corruption if we got rid of all this, all the drug prohibition and legalized all the so-called victimless crimes. I don't think you would still have, mafia hits and then, you know, paying off hundreds of police officers to look the other way when someone just gets murdered, right? I think that's such a serious crime that it wouldn't be as prevalent. I mean, it might still happen, but my point is, I think partly why there is such an epidemic, if you will, of corruption is that these crimes are, in a sense, victimless. Okay, in this slide, corruption, cause, and consequence, I'm just trying to explain to you the point that I made in the book that there's a cycle that goes on here. So on the one hand, I was showing you how drug prohibition leads to corruption because the drug dealers, they get a bunch of money because the price goes up, and then that allows them to offer huge bribes to the police and others to look the other way. And so that's the sense in which the drug prohibition gives the drug dealers the ability to offer these huge bribes, which helps explain the corruption. But then going the other way, when we're trying to understand, well, how are these black market operations possible? Well, it's because of corruption. All right, so what I mean by this picture here is if the authorities were truly draconian, I mean, if they really threatened to behead anyone who was caught dealing drugs, which is what William Bennett, by the way, suggested. He was the drug czar under Ronald Reagan in the 80s, and I don't think he was kidding. I think he said that we should consider beheading drug dealers. If the government actually did that and consistently enforced that rule, then you might see the use of cocaine go way down, right? Because not too many people would be doing it. Just like in Afghanistan under the Taliban, apparently the output of, you know, narcotics that they were sending around the world there was a lot lower than it was after the U.S. liberation. And I'm using that term loosely. Okay, because the Taliban apparently, I mean, they were, say what you will about them, but they were serious about cracking down on drug dealers, apparently. So what I'm saying here is because in countries like the United States and in Mexico, the government is not actually doing everything in its power to crack down on drug use, that they will look the other way, they will accept bribes, that opens up a wedge. And so now you have, so it flows both ways is what I'm saying. That because the government actually, the various officials, are willing to not enforce the laws, or the laws themselves aren't, you know, that severe in terms of killing you, that the worst that's going to happen is you're going to go to jail for life, then that means there are plenty of people now who are willing to take the chance and be drug dealers, and then they can make a bunch of money, and then they can use that money to offer bribes to the authorities. So it sort of goes both ways. And so that explains why are the authorities willing to overlook all this stuff? Well, because they're getting a bunch of money. All right, so that's it sort of flows both ways there. But again, I just want to underscore the huge drug trade in the United States is only possible because so many police officers look the other way. All right, it's not that the wily criminals are evading the police at every step; it's that they're paying the police off regularly. All right, another major topic is the connection between drug prohibition and violence. So this is something that a lot of people, when they talk about the issue of drug legalization, this is one of the main points. But what I do in the textbook, if I do say so myself, is I think I explain it a lot more systematically than you normally will see it done. Okay, and so what I'm going to do now is I will walk you through the various points and explain to you what the conventional argument is, and then say, well, I don't think that's quite right, and then give you what I think is a better argument. All right, but before we get into the specifics, let's just make sure you understand the basic trend here, that there is an unmistakable connection between drug prohibition and violence, and I think the best example of that is alcohol prohibition in the United States. So that's what the top left is a picture of. Bootleggers like Al Capone in Chicago and organized crime in general, when alcohol was illegal in the United States, there was a booming black market trade in it. Okay, so just like today, there were, you know, crime bosses and the mafia and so forth would or deal in heroin and cocaine and marijuana back in the 1920s. In the early 30s under prohibition, alcohol prohibition, you had bootleggers, and that's a term meaning people who illegally made alcohol. And, you know, they had things called speakeasies, which were like bars that were, you know, illegal. They, you know, people would operate them, and so you had to know the password, you had to know where it was to get in there and stuff. But the point was, Americans still were drinking heavily during alcohol prohibition. It's just they had to do it in various ways. And just like today that marijuana is illegal, but culturally it's not very taboo anymore. That everyone does it, that kind of stuff. And people don't really frown upon it too much. That's what alcohol prohibition was like. That so many people would sneak drinks, you know, behind the scenes that it wasn't It wasn't like if you found out that somebody was a mass murderer, if you found out that your neighbor drank whiskey on the weekends with his buddies, you know, behind in the shed or something, that wasn't like finding out that your neighbor and his buddies would kidnap people and kill them, even though technically they were both crimes. Okay, so that's what I'm trying to get across here. But in terms of prohibition and violence, you had gangland slangs. You had, the stuff you heard about Al Capone taking out people, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, things like that, you know, having Tommy guns and driving by and shooting people. I mean, that was all happening, and why? Because they were battling over turf to sell alcohol. And then once alcohol was legalized, once prohibition was ended, that was one of the few good things that FDR did, then all of a sudden alcohol becomes a respectable business. And crime bosses are no longer dealing with selling whiskey and beer. Now all of a sudden it's done by reputable businesses, and lo and behold, the violence disappears. All right, so like I say in the book, if you opened up the newspaper and saw that the CEO of one beer distributor ordered an assassination of the CEO of another beer distributor because he wanted to gain market share, they wouldn't even make sense to you. You'd be reading the story. You'd say, what is this, from The Onion? This wouldn't even compute. That would be such an absurd thing. Yet, if you open the newspaper and read that, you know, a cocaine dealer had his men go shoot a rival because they were arguing over turf in the, you know, in the inner city, well, that would make obvious sense to you. Okay, so there is this clear connection between prohibited drugs and violence. And so that's why I like the alcohol prohibition episode, is because I think a lot of Americans, at least, the way they think about, who are in favor of the drug war, they think that, oh, things like cocaine and marijuana, they're just bad. You know, they're from the devil, and it's no wonder that the people who would sell that kind of stuff are also the same kind of people who would kill you if you cross them. So it doesn't surprise me that drug dealers shoot each other, because they're just crazy, evil people anyway. I think that's how a lot of Americans think about it. But again, that's what's so great about the historical record with alcohol prohibition, is that you can see, no, when it was illegal, organized crime families were the ones running the alcohol trade, and there was lots of violence associated with it. And then once it was legalized, now all of a sudden, you know, alcohol is still bad for you, still causes a lot of problems, but it doesn't cause the problem of people in the business of selling alcohol shooting each other. That has disappeared. So that was due to prohibition. And of course, the picture in the lower right here is the drug gangs in Mexico and all the, you know, new stories about them crossing the border. I mean, if the analysis that I'm giving you is correct, all that stuff would disappear virtually overnight. If they legalized all the drugs that are currently illegal in the United States and Mexico, these drug gangs would disappear quite quickly, and there wouldn't be this issue anymore. Okay, so like I say, now that I've noted the connection between prohibition and violence, let's try to explain, well, why, where is it coming from? Why should there be this connection? So before I give you the reasons I think it's the case, let me just tell you the standard thing you're going to hear. If you're talking to like a regular libertarian, let's say, or free market economist, and you say, hey, why is it that if certain drugs are illegal, there's violence in those industries? Normally what they'll tell you is, but oh, because there's not protection of property rights. That if a rival comes up and sticks a gun to a drug dealer's head and takes his money, the drug dealer can't go to the police and report the crime, because, you know, it's drug money, and so it's, you know, he can't go to the courts and try to get his money back, because it's illegal contraband anyway. And I never thought that was a very good explanation. Because then what that's saying is that the reason we don't have all kinds of violence all over the place is because of the government, you know, keeping all these potential criminals in check. That the reason you don't have violence in the, you know, Coca-Cola or the, you know, the soda pop industry, the reason that executives of Coca-Cola aren't shooting executives at 7-Up or whatever, I mean, those are probably the same company, but you know what I'm saying, is because they know, oh, if we did shoot one of their employees, then they would be able to call the police and we'd get in trouble. And to me, that seems goofy. That at least if you're a hardcore libertarian, you're very skeptical about the effectiveness of government. Certainly if you're a Rothbardian and you think that the courts and everything ought to be legalized anywhere, you know, moved to the private sector, it's a bit weird to be saying that the reason there's violence in the drug trade is because there is one sector where the police don't protect us, and that the reason there's not violence everywhere else is because everywhere else the police are protecting us. All right, so that's what that standard argument implies, and again, that doesn't sound plausible to me. In the textbook, one of the arguments I used for it was, I would say, look, there are certain areas in the inner city where I don't think the police are going to respond to a call anyway. And, like, I know that that's the case. I lived in Chicago in a bad neighborhood when I was in between undergrad and grad school, and my car got broken into, and I called the police. And they said they were going to send somebody. I don't think they did. I think they just took down my information. And I certainly don't think they had five detectives working on my case. What are they going to do? Okay, so there are certain areas in the inner city where the police aren't quick to respond, like a dry cleaner in the inner city that's right next to where drug dealers operate. I don't think that dry cleaner is... I don't think the reason that dry cleaner is not getting shot up a lot compared to the drug employees is because the police will respond to the dry cleaner, right? There's something else going on. That's what I'm getting at. Okay, so what could those other things be? Let's use basic economics and try to figure it out. So the first thing is, I'm going to say drug prohibition raises the marginal benefits of violence. So here, what I'm doing, just to give you the big picture, what I'm doing for you is I'm going to argue drug prohibition raises the marginal benefits of violence and it reduces the marginal cost. And so that's why we get more violence, because it's the benefits of each additional act of violence go up and the costs on the margin of additional acts of violence are lower, so it's not surprising that people end up doing more of it under prohibition. All right, so let me just walk you through the arguments here. Okay, so for raising the marginal benefits, again, look at our standard diagram here, that the price per unit of product goes way up. Now, let's not be sloppy with our description here. It's not so much, a lot of people would say, oh, the returns to drug dealing went way up. But no, it's more accurate to say the monetary returns, okay, because the total return in a sense is the same. Well, not the same, but there's pros and cons, right? With drug prohibition, it's true. Now you get more money for every gram of cocaine that you sell, but you're more likely to go to jail and you're more likely to get shot by a rival and that kind of stuff. Okay, so there's just the trade-off or the list of attributes of becoming a drug dealer, the pros and cons have changed because of prohibition. But what is true is that since now the monetary return is so much higher, meaning the final market price, the markup, if you will, the difference between how much you're selling the product for and how much you have to pay your suppliers to get it, that difference, that markup has gone up. Okay, so because again, it needs to be higher in order to compensate you for the extra risk. But what that means now is that on the margin, if you gain market share, it's more lucrative than it would have been in a market that was, you know, totally legal. So think of it like this. Why would it be silly for the people running a one soda company to try to shoot the people running a different soda company so that they could sell soda to more people? Let's not make it a soda, let's make it like a convenience store. So there's a convenience store on one corner, and then there's a convenience store across the street. And the people in the first convenience store, the owners, you know, they see that there are customers that go into the place across the street, and they say, you know, if we could just keep the people across the street, we could just keep that lot vacant so that there was no business there, or at least no business that was a convenience store. You know, it could be a dry cleaners or something, but just if we could just keep out other convenience store owners from operating across the street, we'd get a lot more business because all the people that used to go there would probably come here. And so maybe we should just make it a policy that if anybody opens a convenience store across the street, we'll shoot them. So why don't we do that? Well, the benefit of doing that in terms of the extra business they would get isn't that high because the margins in their business aren't that high. So in other words, if they did twice as much business, you know, in terms of how many more dollars per month would they be earning take home, you know, it'd be a certain amount, but it wouldn't be astronomical. Okay, because again, they don't get to mark up their product very much. Right? So in other words, the amount they're selling a Snickers bar for to their customers, they have to pay the people who make the Snickers bar a certain amount. So the markup's not that much. Whereas a drug dealer, you know, someone who's standing on the street corner selling cocaine, let's say, and he sees across the corner of the street there's another cocaine dealer. Now that guy, if he says, well, why don't I shoot that guy and just let it be known if anybody tries to sell cocaine on this, you know, on that street corner, I'm going to kill him. When he's running the numbers, I mean, that makes a huge difference, right? If he doubles his business, I mean, in the terms of how much more money he earns per month, it's a big number. Because again, he makes a huge markup on his product in terms of how much does he have to pay wholesale for it, you know, since the distributors to him, versus when he turns around and, you know, sells it in smaller quantities to individual users, he makes a ton of money. Okay, we have far higher markup than the convenience store owner does because it's illegal. Okay, so again, what I'm trying to say there is it's once you're in the drug dealing business to begin with, on the margin, acquiring more customers means a much bigger increment in your take-home pay or your earnings after above your expenses compared to legalized, you know, to industries that are legal. And so that's partly why you're more likely to use violence to keep out competition, is because in this area, again, gaining market share is much more profitable than in other industries. All right. On the other hand, it lowers the marginal cost of violence. So we've just seen how the benefits of taking out your rivals are higher because of prohibition, but now I'm saying also the costs of doing that are lower because of prohibition. All right, so for one thing, if you're a drug dealer in the current environment, you're already breaking a bunch of laws. All right, so you already are on the government's bad side, if you will, and if they want to, they can send you to jail for life probably, depending on what you've been doing. And so on the margin, if you kill somebody and now you've got a homicide under your belt, that's not as significant as compared to the convenience store owner who has been paying his taxes and everything. You know, so in other words, you can run a convenience store without breaking a bunch of laws that could send you to jail for life. And so that's why on the margin, it would be incredibly reckless for you to hire someone to do it yourself to try to shoot the convenience store owner across the street. Because, first of all, like we said in the last slide, the amount of extra money you'd make per month isn't that high. And then second of all, your life would have just changed, right? You would have known before you did that, you would have known, as long as I keep my nose clean, whatever, you know, there's no reason for me to ever go to jail for the rest of my life unless, you know, I get framed for murder or something. But, you know, I haven't done anything that would warrant me going to jail for the rest of my life. Whereas a drug dealer has. And so again, on the margin, it's not that much more dangerous for a drug dealer to use violence because he's already breaking all kinds of laws. And also, he's already paying off all sorts of police officers and judges and whatever. So he's already got that infrastructure in place. So it's easier for a drug dealer to know how to kill somebody and get away with it. And also, because he's in the underworld anyway, he can contact and be in touch with professional killers. Whereas a convenience store owner from scratch who says, I think I want to kill the person across the street, how do I do it? He wouldn't even know what to do. You know, would you go to Google and say, hire a hitman? You know, I mean, you wouldn't even know how to do it. Normal people don't even know how to kill somebody and get away with it. Whereas a drug dealer who's, you know, when it's prohibited, just by their very nature of their occupation, they interact with criminals all the time. And so they would have a much better idea of how to do it and get away with it. And like I said, also because they, you know the police, whatever, they know how the police operate, and they might be able to either pay them off or just know, okay, well, if we do it at this time of day in this area, no one's going to investigate it. Whereas, you know, we don't want to do it over here because that'd be a high profile area, and, you know, the mayor's wife would see the dead body and we'd be in trouble, right? That kind of stuff, to know how to kill somebody and get away with it, is something that seasoned drug dealers would know much more than just some random person drawn, you know, some random entrepreneur. And so, again, that's just another example of how it lowers the marginal cost of doing it. Another thing here, just to make clear, what I mean by what I'm trying to show you here is the institutional effects of the incentives. I don't mean to suggest that you take the same person and with drugs being legalized, he'd be a perfectly mild-mannered businessman. Then you enact drug prohibition, and all of a sudden that same person just transforms, and now, you know, he's wearing gold necklaces and carrying machine guns and shooting people. I'm not saying it's the same person. What I'm saying is the type of people who get attracted into the drug trade will change based on prohibition. Just like slumlords, you know, we said with rent control, that the people who operate apartment units that are in rent-controlled areas, they can't really care about customer service, that they just have to be real tough. If somebody gets behind a rent, kick them out, get somebody else in there. They don't respond to people who care about, you know, if their water heater's broken or something, they don't care. It takes a real gruff person to do that. It's not that the same person magically transforms because of the law. No, it's that the type of personality, the type of people who go into apartment management are going to be different if there's rent control. So the same thing here, if you've got drug prohibition, people who were sort of, I don't know if psychotic is the right word, but homicidal, right? People who have no problem killing people and who have a very short-term horizon, and, you know, they're not afraid of going to jail, with drug prohibition, they have an avenue open to them. They are able to now be millionaires and have all sorts of, you know, henchmen obeying their orders and to live a real glamorous lifestyle, even though, you know, they might be dead by the time they're 35, because of drug prohibition. Whereas if drugs were legalized, there wouldn't be, you know, they could try to be a bank robber maybe, but, you know, it's a lot harder to rob banks than it is to sell drugs. Okay, so that's what I'm getting at, is the type of people that are rewarded by drug prohibition are not the ones you want to be rewarded. It's what happens when there's drug prohibition is they're saying, look, if there are people who aren't that afraid of going to prison, who don't mind being outlaws, and because, you know, they're getting millions of dollars a year, and if they're willing to kill rivals and pay off police officers, well, then we have a job for you. You can be a drug dealer. And that's what people can do, and plenty of people do it day in and day out. Whereas that career opportunity would disappear if they legalized drugs. Okay, and then the last slide, and we'll turn over to your questions, is product purity. So here, the argument is that things like fatal drug overdoses. When I was growing up, there was this basketball star, Len Bias, that got signed by the Boston Celtics, and I think it was cocaine, and he had a heart attack or something because he, you know, was using cocaine, and that was like a real big thing, you know, and that was one of the things that, you know, the anti-drug education, they were telling us kids, you know, see, you want to stay away from this stuff, and you know, not that that message was wrong, but the point is, the people saying that, I think, thought this is why drugs are illegal, is because, look, you can just die after using cocaine one time, and so that's why this stuff is illegal, when no, that's actually got things backwards. The reason a lot of these drugs can kill you on your first use is because they're illegal, okay? That if drugs were totally legalized and you'd go to a pharmacy or maybe some other sort of specialized store and buy them, yeah, I mean, they wouldn't be able to eradicate their long-term addictive properties or, you know, long-term consequences, but in terms of, you know, product impurities, and people, you know, using the wrong amounts, or just things, the product having something mixed in with it, that would largely disappear, because you would have name brand companies producing the stuff. So, I mean, this is pretty obvious when you think about it, that right now, when it's prohibited, you can't have name brand recognition. You're not going to have a major, you know, a company can't develop tamper-proof packaging and then have quality control and ensure that, you know, this is very high purity cocaine. You know, if you buy our stuff, you can be sure that there's nothing mixed in with it, or, you know, heroin or what have you. Just, again, for obvious reasons. If the company were to develop a name brand reputation, well, then everybody would know they were breaking the law. And so the public would say, why aren't you cracking down on them? Right? So things have to be anonymous. They have to be, you know, when people sell drugs, they're in, you know, Ziploc bags or something. They're not in tamper-proof packages the way you go buy aspirin at the store. And, you know, I mean, technically somebody could get something in there, but you get the idea that it's a lot. You have a much more assurance when you go to the store and buy aspirin that that product is what it's supposed to be than if you go to a street corner and buy a bag of marijuana from somebody. You don't know what's in. Okay, sorry for the freeze. We're back. Going back to the alcohol prohibition, again, you see it's like a textbook experiment that there are a lot more people dying of alcohol poisoning, you know, adjusted for the population size and things like that, during the prohibition years than when it was legal. And one of the reasons for this, I'll end on this point, besides what I just told you about, you know, not having name brand recognition, is that the consumer has an incentive to go for the harder drug, whether it's alcohol or marijuana or what have you, because because what you're trying to do is do stuff, you know, outside the view of the general public and the authorities. You want to concentrate it. So with alcohol, people who, when it was legal, might have had beer, you know, maybe their drink of choice was beer, maybe they would switch to whiskey, because if you want to just go out occasionally and go find somebody to, you know, sell you bootleg liquor, to get the same buzz, you could get a much smaller bottle of whiskey than if you bought beer. All right. And so if you want to, like I said, you just go out, you know, meet behind a tree or something in the forest down the street with somebody, and he's going to, you know, has something in his overcoat and opens up and gives you a bottle and you give him some money, you're not going to want to get a bottle of beer, because that's going to last you a day, right? You're going to want to get a bottle of whiskey that you can sip and, you know, that'll last you a while, so you don't have to keep going out and meeting that guy every day, because you want to minimize that, because it's risky. You can get caught, or your neighbor could see you, and, you know, rumors would spread, that kind of stuff. So the point is, the consumers, the customers, have an incentive to go for harder stuff, as well as the producers, that you don't want to, you know, with alcohol prohibition, you don't want to have your trunk loaded with beer that you can only sell for a certain amount per liter. You want to have whiskey, because you can charge a lot more per liter, since, you know, you're in trouble anyway, one way or the other. You might as well fill your trunk up with something that's really lucrative, which, you know, you can charge more for the more potent stuff. Right, so that's the idea, that you don't have the quality control that you would in the legal industry, and ironically, prohibition pushes people to go after the harder stuff. And so, in terms of minimizing unintended, you know, reactions or things like that, you know, overdoses, stuff like that, actually prohibition arguably makes that stuff a lot worse. Okay, so I will stop there. Let me see if you guys have posted any questions in the regular forum. And remember, I said this at the beginning, I have graded your midterms. And so if you haven't seen what your grade is, you can go ahead and log in and check it. Okay, just bear with me. Okay, Luis Ignacio says, Professor Murphy, I'm starting my thesis bachelor dissertation on the economics of drug prohibition. I'm currently using Mark Thornton's Economics of Prohibition, a couple of Gary Becker's essays on the subject, and Timothy Lynch's After Prohibition from Cato. Do you know of any other good sources for further reading? I'm especially interested in the Austrian perspective, but any sound analysis will work. Well, yeah, so Thornton's book, The Economics of Prohibition, was the best one that I found when I was, because I did a similar thing in, it was for my master's at NYU. So I didn't get a master's degree, I just went right to the PhD, but I took a master's level class for some reason that's escaping me now, and we had to do a paper in that, and so I did it on the connection between drug prohibition and violence. If I could find that, I would send it to you, but I did that like two computers ago, so I'm skeptical of being able to find that. But anyway, if I do, I'll send it to you. But I incorporated a lot of my arguments into the Lessons for the Young Economist. So anyway, to answer your question, yeah, when I was working on that, Thornton's book was the single best one that I had found. There was something called Our Right to Drugs. But I can't remember, I don't know if that was Thornton or somebody else, but that was a pretty good one. And unfortunately, I would say if you're doing that, I don't think you should be asking me. I think you should email Mark Thornton, because he would, I mean, that's his area. He would know better than I would. Because there's probably like actual journal articles on this stuff besides just books. Okay, I don't see any other questions pertaining to this week's material, so I'll go ahead and answer the other ones. But again, for those of you tuned in right now, we got about 18 minutes left. If you want to post questions in the forum, Danny, maybe you can give them the link to make sure they know how to get. Well, I guess I could do that too. I think this URL that I'm going to paste in here is what you need. So anyway, if you have questions about drug prohibition, feel free to post them here and I'll answer them, but until such time, I'll answer these other ones. So Vincent Wales says, without some form of tax, how can the free market account for externalities in the true cost of goods sold? For example, a factory that pollutes a local river with effluent in a country where there are no laws preventing this. So the standard answer here, Vincent, is that this is a problem of property rights enforcement. And so it's true if you're stipulating for the argument that there's going to be a government judicial system, things get a little bit arbitrary, because then you're saying the government should fine you for dumping water in the river instead of taxing you or something like that. So it does get a little bit arbitrary. I mean, ideally, if you're coming from a Murray Rothbard type perspective, this would all be privatized. And then we could talk about how the legal system would recognize these sorts of issues. If you want, Vincent, I've written an article on how the free market might deal with climate change. And so that's what I did. I said, assume the whole world is Rothbardian, and assume for the sake of argument that emitting greenhouse gases really will cook everybody 100 years from now if we don't do something about it. what would the free market do if we don't have governments around to implement carbon taxes? So I can send you that if you want. But as far as like the standard libertarian Austrian response to your question, there's a couple things. So one is just the knowledge problem that it's naive to think that the government planners are going to be able to correctly calculate the externality and then figure out what the optimal Pigovian tax is, you know, necessary to defray it. The other thing is, even if they did know that, why would they do it? Right, the government right now does all kinds of things that we know aren't good. You know, the government has tariffs in place, even though economists can demonstrate, well, no, that's not good for society's welfare. You're imposing losses on consumers that aren't counterbalanced by the gains of the producers. You should get rid of the tariff, and they don't, because it's not, they don't need to. You know, politically, they do better by having the tariff in place. Okay, so I don't like these conventional market failure arguments for why government ought to do something, because even if the argument were true, that doesn't mean actual real-world politicians would do it. All right, that they would use it as a pretext to then do what they want. And I'm speaking somewhat from experience, because I've worked a lot in on the energy issues, and I can just, you know, I can tell you the arguments for you know, cap and trade, the legislation, that sort of thing. I mean, it's the legislation, even using their own models and using their own numbers and thing, the legislation doesn't do what they say it's going to do. All right, so I think to understand, why are they passing this legislation? Well, because it gives them a lot more power, and because they get to hand out carbon credits and things like that to the, you know, their political buddies. And so they certainly benefit from having this huge new system put into place, but I don't for one second believe that the reason it's happening is because people in Washington are concerned about Bangladesh being flooded in 60 years. But the one more thing on your question, Vincent, the standard argument is that, ironically, it was government intervention in the Industrial Revolution that overturned conventional property rights. So apparently under the, and I don't know if this is true historically, but I'm just repeating what the standard argument is, under like the common law, if you live downstream from a factory and they start dumping sludge in the river, and you know the river that you go to get your water from, you'd go to the judge and you'd say, hey, I want an injunction against that factory. They're violating my property rights. And then the judge might tell them to stop. But during the Industrial Revolution, it was thought that, well, no, we don't want to hamper progress, and we need to have industry, it's unavoidable that they need to dump stuff in the river, and so they would throw out those suits. Okay, and so a lot of like people like Murray Rothbard and Walter Block would say, it's not a fault of capitalism if the government refuses to enforce property rights. That's just showing you why you shouldn't have the government in charge of protecting property rights. That, you know, that's so anyway, that's the standard argument for that. Okay, I think those are the only questions on here. I'll refresh the page and see if anyone else has anything. Looks like not. So we've just got about 17 people logged in right now. Does anyone else have any question? I mean, you could post it even right in the public chat here. We don't have too many people. Well, I guess I have convinced you all of the economic case against drug prohibition then. All right, well, I guess there's no law saying we got to end at 6:30 on my time, so why don't we stop there a few minutes early, and I will see you guys next week. I'll send out the office hours, and remember, as always, do your your multiple choice questions when we get those posted. Okay, thanks everybody.